From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with John Barth, one of America's leading novelists. His books include The Floating Opera, The Sotweet Factor, and a new novel titled The Tidewater Tales. Also today, I talk with prosecuting attorney-turned-novelist Scott Turow. His best-selling book, Presumed Innocent, is about a prosecutor charged with murder. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Happy Hour, the new album by country blues singer Ted Hawkins. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews La Bamba, the story of rock star Richie Valens. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is writer John Barth. He's widely considered one of the most inventive and imaginative of American novelists. His 9 works of fiction include The Floating Opera, The End of the Road, The Sotweet Factor, Giles Goatboy, Chimera, and Sabbatical. Chimera was the winner of the 1973 National Book Award for Fiction. Barth's rich imagery and complex style have drawn comparisons with writers like Nabokov, Borges, and Beckett. Of his own skill, Barth has said, "There are writers whose gift is to make terribly complicated things simple, but I know my gift is the reverse, to take relatively simple things and complicate them to the point of madness." John Barth describes his new novel, The Tidewater Tales, as a 655-page maximalist novel about a minimalist writer. Its main character is a writer with writer's block. His wife is an oral historian 8.5 months pregnant with twins. For much of the novel, they sail around the Chesapeake telling stories to try to break his block while waiting out the end of her pregnancy. Like several of his novels, The Tidewater Tales is a book of stories within stories. John Barth is a native of the Eastern Shore of Maryland, where he now spends much of his free time. He lives in Baltimore and teaches writing at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to open with a reading from your new novel, Tidewater Tales. Would you read an excerpt from it for us?
Well, I'll be happy to, though there is a difference between fiction for the ear and fiction for the eye, and this is a novel meant to be read. Nevertheless, it is a novel about storytelling, and I hope that it's rhythms and cadences are the cadences of storytelling, since that's the thing I'm very fond of. The novel is divided into 2 main parts. There's the longest prologue in literary history called Our Story, which tells us how this not-so-young man and his not-so-young wife, both of them at the end of their 30s, happened to be in the middle of Chesapeake Bay in a little sailboat named, I'm sorry to say, Story, without an engine, she 8.5 months pregnant, involved in a kind of race between Genesis on the one hand and Apocalypse on the other, since they're worried about the world ending before their babies are born, maybe before the prologue ends. And then the main section of the novel called Our Stories, which we'll come to in a moment. Here's a little snippet from the prologue, Our Story, where the action really begins. The couple are sitting around. They know what their problems are, but the reader doesn't quite yet. And at one point, Catherine Sherritt Sagamore, the wife of the couple, says to her husband, Peter Sagamore, "Tell me a story." To Peter Sagamore's surprise, Kathy Sherritt puts a hand on each side of his rowing hand, stopping the action. They're out there rowing their little boat home, trying to. Then kisses the hand she has thus framed and says, as if she'd been waiting to be asked, "Tell me a story." "What?" "Story." "Can't." "A story," she insists to her friend's brown hand. "Tell me a story of women and men like us. In love for 10 years the way we've been, married for 2, 2.5. What I want to hear about in particular is their houses increase." "Their what?" "Houses increase." Kathy pushes hair back off her forehead. "Houses increase. Like there they've been. Healthy, happy, more or less successful, well enough off, in love and faithfully loved, the favorite of the bloody earth like us. And yet, in early middle age, with perfect freedom of choice and the world going to hell in a handbasket all around them, I mean stuff like nuclear proliferation, the U.S. economy rusting out, the natural environment clogging up, the national infrastructure crumbling away, no money to rebuild it, that sort of thing. In the midst of this, they break their behinds and disrupt their lives to bring an innocent kid on stage, maybe just in time to see the curtain fall. 2 or 3 innocent kids. What are they? Sentimental? Hubristic? Oblivious? Nuts?" She rests her chin upon her frowning husband's hand and speaks now to his belly. I mean, don't they care that their kids could be atomized or caught up in the worst convulsions this country's ever experienced? Do they finally not believe what everybody says is almost certain to happen, since nobody's doing much to prevent it, probably couldn't do much even if they wanted to? Or do they think their genes are such hot stuff that any kid of theirs will ride the apocalypse like a hobby horse? Says wondering Peter, who has seldom heard his friend at once so calmly and so impassionedly eloquent, "Tell me more." "No," says Catherine to his chest. "Now you tell me, did they consider all these things just as we did and go ahead anyhow, figuring they'll pay the bill but not count the cost?" "Pay the bill but not count the cost," Peter marvels. "That's very well put, Kath. So use it in the story," she says. "Tell me all about it. Tell me their story as if it weren't our story, but enough like our story so that the gods of storytelling will take the helm and man the sheets and blow us and it to a harbor we never could have predicted." Boy, oh boy, Peter Sagamore's look is pained indeed. "Don't I wish I could."
That's great. It's my guest John Barth reading from his new novel, The Tidewater Tales. We're very interested in the gods of storytelling.
Yes, I am.
As your character describes it. And they tell stories within the novel, and you're very interested in the idea of the novel as having stories within stories. And I think the best symbol of that is Scheherazade, who you've actually written a novel about. To refresh our memory, before we talk about stories within stories, would you briefly refresh our memory about the story of Scheherazade?
Yes, it's the greatest of the frame stories that we have, I think, in human literature. The stories Scheherazade tells are, I think, less impressive than the story of Scheherazade, which every reader, which every listener, I'm sure, knows about, even if they've never read The Thousand and One Nights, because it's one of those wonderful stories that we all know whether we've read the text or not. What could be more amazing than to write a story like that? Scheherazade lives in an unnamed oriental kingdom, the sultan of whom is a woman-hater because his wife has deceived him, and who resolves, everybody remembers, to take a woman to bed every night, a virgin to bed every night, and kill her in the morning before she can be unfaithful to him. The arch-misogynist Scheherazade, a young woman who is the daughter of the Secretary of State and who knows all about this business, volunteers herself to her father's horror. And then what everybody remembers is that she beguiles the king for 1,001 nights by telling him stories which she never finishes the same night she begins them. She so charms the king that he says, "I won't kill her till I've heard the end of her stories." At the end of 1,001 nights, she's not out of stories yet, but she asks for a favor. The king says, "What?" She says, "Marry me for the sake of our children." Turns out she's had three children by him in this meanwhile. And he does, not for their sake, really, but for the sake of her stories, and they live happily ever after. To me, she's the tutelary genius of storytelling. We all, I think, certainly all professional writers, but in a way, all of us, I think, are alive only as long as we're telling stories to one another. How was your day? How was your life? Let me tell you about mine, etc.
Do you see Scheherazade as the metaphor for the novelist?
Oh, very much so. Not only in an age like ours, where we hear in some quarters that the novel isn't the vigorous animal that it was in the 18th and 19th century, so we may all feel that we're sort of terminal. But even before that, even in the great ages of written fiction of the novel, even then, no writer has ever been better than the next thing. I mean, it's not enough ever, and properly so, to have written one good novel, five good novels, as some of the 19th century novelists did, two dozen good novels. You're still only as good as the next one. We live that way as professional writers, and I think as readers, we properly regard other writers that way.
Well, in the Scheherazade story, she is saved from death by being able to tell this long, never-ending story that goes on for 1,001 nights. Do you feel that your ability to tell good stories has saved you from a terrible fate?
Well, it saved me from silence. The fate that at least this writer hopes for is not a kind of tenure, which is what the king awards Scheherazade in a way, the relative tenure and stability of marriage. In our vainest moments, we may hope for a kind of immortality, that is, that people will be reading our stories when we're gone. But what we really hope to do from year to year and decade to decade of our professional lives is keep people reading our sentences. It's a marvelous and luxurious fate, after all, and therefore a delicate and fragile one, to be allowed by the world to do what you'd be doing anyway, and actually know that now and then people out there are not only reading these stories, but being entertained by them, being charmed and beguiled by them. Yes, we're all Scheherazades.
A lot of modern writers, and I'm thinking especially of experimental fiction writers, have abandoned the story. They abandon narrative form to just work on language itself. It seems to me what you've done is figured out an experimental form for the novel that has the story as a vital part of it.
Well, God knows whether I've done it, but it's certainly what I've attempted to do. The great modernists, Joyce and Eliot, Pound, and so forth, left us with a tradition by, let's say, around the time of the Second World War, the tradition in narrative writing that plot was not very important. In fact, that it was a kind of insufferable artifice. There's a sort of a hi-fi realism to that attitude toward literature. I sympathize with that. It's this point of view about literature that I cut my apprentice teeth on. But modernism in that aspect really is a bit behind us now. It's unquestionably the great impressive movement in all the arts in the first half of the 20th century. Some of us feel that that noble movement belongs to the first half of the 20th century. And those of us who are sometimes rightly or wrongly identified with the term postmodernist, those of us who are writers, may feel that what that consists of is not going back to the 19th century as if the first half of the 20th hadn't happened, you understand, but finding a way to have it both ways. That's my house motto, to have it both ways with these things. To write as cunningly and guilefully and I hope charmingly as one can on the level of the individual sentences and of structure, but at the same time to do what the great storytellers have always done, tell stories and charm readers with those stories. If we can't do that, it seems to me at this point in the century, we're missing the boat and then the novel and literature really would be in trouble. But a great many of us are, I hope, managing to do that.
You said you cut your teeth on the idea that literature should be moving away from story as the center.
It was often said, for example, oh, my distinguished fellow writer, John Hawkes, one of the American novelists whom I admire most strongly, is famous for a statement, made a famous statement a few decades ago, that he regards plot, character, and I've forgotten, and theme, let's say, as the natural enemies of fiction. You know, that's not a statement that Hawks would make today, and it's not a statement that I hope would ever make. You know, I think artifice in the sense of plot and of the kind of characters we associate with, interesting characters, colorful characters, these are the very meat of the art of fiction, I believe.
My guest is novelist John Barth. One of the things that you once said about literature, as a matter of fact, it was one of your slightly tongue-in-cheek great rules of literature, is that whatever else it's about, great literature is almost always about itself.
Almost always also about itself. That's quite so. It sounds a little tiresome when you hear it. You know, one more example of the self-consciousness that has plagued the 20th century in general and the modernist movement in particular. And that's true. We are in and out of the arts. We are a terribly self-conscious century, just as we're a media-conscious generation. It's inevitable that that would be reflected in all our arts, certainly in the art of literature. But what I mean is something that goes back way past the modernist movement, back to the very origins of literature, a kind of fascination that literature has had with the fact that it is words, that it is stories being told. We see it in Homer, who introduces the blind bard Demodocus to tell the story that Homer's in the middle of telling about the Trojan War. We see it in Shakespeare, in the Greek tragedians. They're always playing on the fact that this is a play. All the world's a play. All the men and women merely players, etc. That's the kind of awareness of itself that I'm speaking of. Nothing more tiresome, I hope, than that.
Your main character in your new novel, The Tidewater Tales, has writer's block, or what you describe as the legendary, the celebrated, the unspeakably tiresome writer's block.
Yes.
Have you ever had writer's block?
Not for more than a day or so, but that may be that I'm in the habit of measuring my own literary output by semesters and by seasons rather than what we hear Ernest Hemingway used to do, writing on the wall beside the toilet in his bathroom the number of words he had written this year. I should think this would be bad both for your natural hygiene and also for your output. Peter Sagamore's writer's block is the kind of thing that ordinary writer's block when it happens.
This is your character, Peter Sagamore.
Yes, the hero of the Tidewater Tales. He's not blocked in that tiresome way of just a writer's problem. If that was the case, I wouldn't be interested in him, neither should any reader be. No, he's a man whose problems, whose silence have come from a number of different causes. He is an arch minimalist. You mentioned this early in our conversation. Minimalism, of the sort practiced by Samuel Beckett and echoed in a great many of our very best younger American writers, U.S. writers today, is an honorable aesthetic. The slogan that we get from Mies van der Rohe and others, that less is more, is an inarguable proposition. I'm by temperament happen to be a maximalist, and so I'm interested in that phenomenon. Peter has minimalized himself into a corner of absolute silence, but it's not only for literary aesthetic reasons. There are reasons that involve his involvement on the margins of some things that have been going on in Washington. It involves his anxiety about bringing children into the world, perhaps at the very edge of the apocalypse, a very understandable anxiety, particularly for somebody who lives on Chesapeake Bay, I think, when we're so close to the scene of the action where decisions are made and the targets loom large. He says he has seven various reasons for falling silent, and the novel deals with those.
Well, you've described yourself as a maximalist writing about a minimalist. And, I mean, not only is the book very long, but you really write some very long sentences.
They tend to go on a ways before they stop, don't they?
Well, I wonder if that's part of a discipline to you, too. I mean, if you... What's your interest in writing really long, well-crafted sentences?
Well, long novels, to speak to that first, are, of course, an enormous imposition on civilized attention, especially at a time of history when we're told from every quarter that the human attention span, even of lively, intelligent people, is not what it was in the 19th century, when both in their pleasures and in the other areas of life, people were trained for sustained concentration. Still, other than just impotent perverse that maybe makes me want to go against the grain, if everybody else is writing short, I'm going to write long. There is the inarguable truth that some things take a while to say. Now, the English language, that gorgeous language that I practice and privileged to practice, has lovely possibilities in the ways of structures that go on for a while. It also happens that I am the last kid on the block to compose with a fountain pen and not a word processor. And there's something about the flow of ink on the page, I think, that makes my sentences go on away before I pick up the pen and put the period.
Well, it becomes almost acrobatic, too, don't you think, when you're working a really, really long sentence?
It is a bit like the juggler trying to keep two ten bins, three bowling balls, and an egg in the air at the same time, hoping not to get egg on his face, yes.
My guest is novelist John Barth. His new novel is titled The Tidewater Tales. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Novelist John Barth is my guest. His new book is titled The Tidewater Tales. Well, we've established how interested you are in storytelling, and I wonder if there are any terrific storytellers or gossipers in your family that you grew up hearing.
My father had the misfortune to be very hard of hearing, and like many deaf or partially deaf people, he made up for this by being a tireless anecdotist. I don't know whether these things get passed down in the genes. They certainly can get passed down through family situations. Since he couldn't hear us, he talked to us and he told us stories. And so I grew up certainly listening to lots of anecdotes. These were not fanciful stories. It was not my good fortune to have the experience that an Indian writer friend of mine, Salman Rushdie, the Indian expatriate British novelist, said he had growing up in Bombay. His father told him and his siblings bedtime stories from the Arabian Nights, and the kid thought his father was making up these stories. A lovely beginning for a writer. My father's stories were about people on the Eastern Shore, people whom he'd met that day in his daily rounds, and he told them awfully well.
Did you were you verbal as a child?
Was I verbal? I was twins. Had the interesting fortune to be twins. I'm half of a pair of opposite sex twins, and my twin sister and I, like many twins early in our lives, found that we had a language that was hardly language. I mean, language was almost unnecessary among them. I think I probably got verbal when I went to school. Then, when you're not with your twin and you have to start talking to other people, one becomes verbal. Maybe more verbal for not having begun that way.
When did you start writing?
I started writing fiction in a kind of serious way when I was an undergraduate at college. I just stumbled into it. I didn't go there to be a writer. I'd wanted to be a musician didn't work out.
A jazz musician.
Hadn't the talent, a jazz musician. Went up to Juilliard from high school to study orchestration, but I played jazz drums. Found I hadn't the talent. Came home and had to scratch around for the next thing to do. Went to college and had the good luck to fall into the hands of a splendid Spanish poet, Pedro Salinas, with whom I read Don Quixote. And the introduction was not just to the first living poet writer I'd ever met. He was an exile from Franco Spain, but to what remains one of my four favorite narrative works in all literature, Don Quixote.
So you went from jazz drumming to writing.
Jazz writing.
So you went from one art to another. You knew you weren't going to go into textiles or business administration.
That's true. There is such a thing as vocation, I realize, and he or she is lucky who has it, whether that means you've got the talent or not, which is quite another subject. I found in the case of music, for example, that while I was enormously interested in it and had a little bit of ability, I didn't have that vocation. I didn't have that sense that this is exactly what I'm going to do, whether I do it well or badly. And I found by a kind of backdoor or sidelong movement that was the case with writing. I knew after my first year of doing it in college that was what I'd spend my life doing, whether I got anywhere with it or not. That, I suppose, is what vocation consists of. God knows, as in most arts, it's certainly full of discouragement, and that doesn't stop. I mean, there are always people willing to tell you you should have stayed with jazz drumming or whatever.
Did you have a hard time convincing your parents that this was your vocation and you're going to follow it?
Not at all. I was in the enviable position. At least I envy it when I see the opposite among some of my own students and coachees, I would call them, at Johns Hopkins. The happy fortune of having parents who were not – these were the Depression years. They were the children of first-generation immigrants. They didn't have the privilege of going to college, and they were delighted if any of their children finished high school. So there's a kind of wonderful freedom in that. If I had told them I was going to be a metaphysician or a court poet, I think they would have said, well, gee, that's nice. We'll do whatever we can. And they did.
You got a scholarship to go to Johns Hopkins University.
Yes.
And you were from a working-class background, and it's a very expensive school, and usually people come from the finest educational backgrounds and comfortable families to go there. Did you feel uncomfortable? Did you feel out of place?
Well, I think given my own background growing up in the Tidewater Marshes in a quite small town, not a deprived background, but not what in today's jargon we would call an enriched background, certainly. We didn't feel that we were deprived, at least. But we certainly didn't have the access to literature, to the arts, to civilization generally that products of a good private school would have. At that point, I think I would have felt on an alien planet being anywhere else at all. And yes, that's the way I felt in my first couple of undergraduate years at Johns Hopkins. I would have felt the same, I think, in any good school. I would have felt the same simply moving to the city. So that was no big deal. At the same time, I loved it. And though I had the sense that I would never catch up, I soon understood that I would at least do my best to give him a good race.
Well, did that make you feel frantic or excited? Let's face it, you'd spend so much time as a jazz drummer, you weren't reading the great classics or anything.
And true. And there
and
was
Hopkins
the happy
more than other places, I think.
Yeah, they had a rigorous
Yeah, you really have to be very well
background.
Versed.
In those days, one was expected not to be versed but to become versed in the classics of the history of ideas and literary classics as well. Splendid introduction to them to come in at that level. I was both intimidated and inspired, and finally I think the enthusiasm won out over the intimidation, especially because I soon found that writing was what I wanted to do, and that's not basically an intellectual enterprise, though it's not removed from the general – and I was still playing jazz drums weekends, which was a kind of way of touching base with something more familiar and with which I could relax.
You are now teaching at Johns Hopkins, where you
Yes.
went to school on a scholarship. Do you ever see students who remind you of yourself?
Now and then in the respect of students with a lot of steam in their boilers, but not a lot of polish yet, diamonds in the rough. Sometimes they turn out to be rhinestones in the rough, along with the diamonds in the smooth. It was a pleasure to come back there after 20 or 25 years of teaching up north away from my beginnings. The place you come back to is not the place you left. It changes, and you have changed at the same time. The students I choose for our advanced courses in fiction writing at Hopkins, I'll say, are of a level of proficiency so much better than I was at their stage that I understand, like Groucho Marx, that he said he would never belong to a club that would have him for a member. I could not have been admitted to the seminar I now coach, but that's a happy feeling.
My guest is novelist John Barth. And I think it was 1964 you were writing about the tragic view of life in an essay that
I
you did.
I still subscribe to it.
Okay, well, you wrote, the tragic view of life is that the human condition is essentially ironic and technically absurd. And I think it's fair to say that your first novels certainly had that as their theme. Do you still subscribe to that, and do you think that it's still the theme, finally, of your novels?
The tragic view of life, which is that that there is finally no settling of scores, that there is no great redress of injustices in some golden hereafter, I'm afraid I do still subscribe to. But I don't regard it, as I perhaps did as a young man when I was writing those first novels, I don't anymore regard it as a particularly gloomy view. It was infected with a kind of innocent nihilism in the novels I wrote in my 20s, which I have outgrown, perhaps simply because I relish life itself more as I get older. That's not such an uncommon pattern. Not gloomy at all. When Peter Sagamore and Catherine Sherritt, the hero and heroine of the Tidewater Tales novel, speak of the tragic view of everything from the CIA to the writing of literature, there's nothing hopeless in their feeling. No, on the contrary, the name of the game is to work with some spirit and enthusiasm without deluding yourself that you're finally going to make an enormous difference in the world or that somehow everything's going to come out all right, because in general I think it does not. But that's not an argument for quietism or certainly not for defeatism. The Greek tragedians understood that, and in my modest late 20th century way I feel that too.
Is this worldview that you've applied to life and literature your kind of substitute for religion?
Well, it certainly has for me the force of a kind of religious belief, with the famous difference, of course, that it doesn't lead to any particular object of worship. Only, I think, I hope, a kind of pleasure in rejoicing in celebration of and crossing your fingers about life, civilization, and the future of the arts and of you. In my view, modernism shifts to postmodernism in literature, for example, at about the time when many people of my generation, like myself, stopped worrying about the death of the novel and began worrying about the death of the reader, all the readers, civilization in general. That, for me, would be the benchmark of the postmodernist spirit. We get over some of those earlier, rather more academic preoccupations into things that I think are much larger, richer, and more troublesome preoccupations. I'm much more worried about what's going to happen to readers who read literature and love literature, then what's going to happen? Who cares, finally, what happens to a particular little mode of literature like the novel? I hope it dies a nice, long, happy death, which it's been doing for hundreds of years and may for hundreds of years yet, if the world doesn't end first.
One final question. When you're reading for pleasure, do you ever read pop novels of any form? Or genre novels of any kind?
No, I'm afraid I don't. Now and then, mainly to do homework, for example. If the CIA is going to put its unsavory finger into my fiction, I'll go read a few CIA exposés, but also a few knowledgeable spy novels like John le Carré's, for example. And I find, God forgive me, that I can't enjoy even the good ones. There's something about that medium, and perhaps about pop literature in general. Then I remind myself, though, that Homer was a popular writer, that Dante was a popular writer, that Cervantes was a bestseller. And we're reminded that in some fortunate periods, anyhow, it's possible for a great writer to have it both ways in that sense as well.
Do you feel like you have?
I feel like I feel as though I can imagine no fate better. No, I don't feel that I've achieved that memorable objective yet. That's perhaps what keeps me going. But I can't imagine a better goal than that.
John Barth, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome.
My guest has been writer John Barth. His novels include The Floating Opera, The End of the Road, The Sotweed Factor, and Chimera. His new novel, The Tidewater Tales, is published by Putnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with jazz critic and producer Leonard Feather, who's written a memoir titled The Jazz Years. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, attorney and best-selling novelist Scott Turow talks about the law in fact and fiction. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews La Bamba, based on the life and death of rock and roller Ritchie Valens. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Happy Hour, the new album from Ted Hawkins, the veteran country blues singer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Singer Ted Hawkins was almost 46 by the time his first album, Watch Your Step, was released in 1982. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of his new album, Happy Hour.
Ooh, baby, baby, please don't you let me go. No, darling, don't make me explain it. I don't know why, but I don't want to.
Ted Hawkins is a 51-year-old man from Mississippi. Up until just a year ago, he made his living singing on the boardwalk in Venice Beach, California, for spare change. He's been in and out of jail for much of his life, often put there for little more than jaywalking or loitering. Hawkins has been playing the guitar and singing since he was a child, but until recently, none of his attempts to make it in the music business had panned out. His austere yet eclectic music doesn't seem to fit any label. It mixes soul and country and pop and the blues. His voice doesn't fit in with the music industry of the 80s either. It's rough and deep and knowing. Hawkins sounds like Sam Cooke would if Sam Cooke had lived a long, hard life. But over the past year, Ted Hawkins has recorded two albums for Rounder Records, and he's beginning to attract attention. Here's a cut from his latest album, Happy Hour. The song is My Last Goodbye.
Hey, baby, what you gonna do without me? Hey, baby, don't you think I'm cool? I may not be the best in the West, but I'm the best that you have, little girl. Places I can't go, so many things that I don't know, but one thing I know, I want you, I want you. Hey, treat me right, turn out the lights, we're gonna make a little loving tonight, make me feel real good, hold me real tight, love me all.
Bye. an angel from above. I don't la 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 la. I done said my last goodbye. Yeah, what you gonna do without me, baby? What you gonna do when I'm dead and gone? What you gonna do without me?
That was Ted Hawkins from his new album, Happy Hour. It took a small independent label like Rounder Records in Boston to take a chance on Hawkins. These days, no major label is going to sign someone who sounds as rough and original as Ted Hawkins. His music isn't smooth and lulling like Whitney Houston, or predictably noisy like Motley Crue. Instead, Hawkins taps into a whole history of popular music, from early country to modern rhythm and blues. In concert, Hawkins has been known to sing a terrific version of Webb Pierce's honky-tonk classic, There Stands the Glass. And on this new album, he offers a beautiful interpretation of Curtis Mayfield's Gypsy Woman. The sound of Ted Hawkins is a sound we don't hear often enough. In England, there's already an audience that appreciates him. Both of his albums have topped the record charts there, primarily because an influential disc jockey on BBC Radio 1 loved Hawkins' music and played him repeatedly. Here, where pop music radio is profoundly conservative, it's impossible for even an influential DJ, and there really aren't any of those anymore, to program music as unusual as Ted Hawkins. But at least these records are available to those who want to seek him out. I would think that you big chillers out there who pine for the glory days of the Temptations and Marvin Gaye could get behind this fresh, passionate music. Ted Hawkins deserves a break in his own country.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's more from Ted Hawkins' album, Happy Hour.
Gonna leave here walking tomorrow night.
Gonna leave here walking tomorrow night.
Got to see this place, they say it's out of sight.
Gonna leave here walking tomorrow.
Everybody I talk to say, California is a swinging place. Come on, come and go with me. We can see the setting of the sun.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is lawyer and novelist Scott Turow. His first novel is the new bestseller, Presumed Innocent. It's receiving a lot of attention for two reasons: the book and movie bidding wars it provoked, and the praise Turow's writing has received from book critics. Turow was an assistant U.S. attorney in Chicago for 8 years before he joined a high-powered firm where he now defends white-collar criminals. Presumed Innocent is the story of Rusty Sabich, a big city deputy prosecuting attorney who, in the middle of investigating the murder of his colleague, a former lover, finds himself on trial accused of the crime. The novel opens with Savage, the prosecutor, wondering how it would feel if the tables were turned and he was the defendant. I asked Scott Turow to read that passage.
In the beginning, I was often preoccupied, imagining how it would feel to sit there, held at the focus of scrutiny, ardently denounced before all who cared to listen, knowing that the most ordinary privileges of a decent life, common trust, personal respect, and even liberty, were now like some cloak you had checked at the door and might never retrieve. I could feel the fear, the hot frustration, the haunted separateness. Now, like ore deposits, the harder stuff of duty and obligation has settled in the veins where those softer feelings moved. I have a job to do. It is not that I have grown uncaring. Believe me.
Does a prosecuting attorney have to stop identifying with the defendants who are on trial and distance himself from them?
Actually, Terry, for me, as a prosecuting attorney, the process was almost the reverse. I started out not identifying with the defendants, horrified by their conduct, and only over a number of years did I begin to sit back and recognize that the people I was prosecuting were not a lot different than anybody else, and began to think a lot about the connection between those who did things that were evil and those who prosecuted them.
Do you think the legal system looks different to someone standing trial than it does to the lawyers who are arguing the case?
I think without doubt it looks a lot different to the person standing trial. And I must say that to the credit of many judges before whom I appeared, they always seemed to bear that in mind. They were most concerned with how the system would appear to those who were feeling its harshest lashes. And there is no doubt that when you are at the focus of scrutiny, to quote myself, that everything takes on an extraordinary meaning and probably strangeness.
Is your legal writing anything like your fiction? I haven't read a lot of legal briefs, and I don't know if they're traditionally dry or very descriptive.
Legal writing is generally very dry, and indeed, most of my colleagues, wherever it is that I found myself practicing over the years, have a tendency to kind of tone me down. There's really a limited lexicon that the lawyer can reach for. Emotion is not supposed to be part of the lawyer's armory, and you are supposed to be appealing to reason. Of course, legal decision-making, like all other decision-making in life, takes people through their feeling states as well, but the approach to that is much more guarded and much more subtle. And so legal writing, I think, has got a sleep-inducing character to most people who are not lawyers.
Do you think of yourself as good when it comes time to making final arguments before the jury?
Yeah, that of course is the most emotional vocabulary that lawyers are permitted, and for whatever it is to swing incense at oneself in terms of legal abilities, I tended to think I was better at that than a lot of other legal skills.
You were writing fiction before you went to law school, the way I understand it. Why did you go to law school instead of just turning to writing?
Well, it sounds peculiar for me, with a book that has done as well as Presumed Innocent has, to say this, but I do mean it. I don't think anybody in his or her right mind can count on making a living as a writer of fiction. And for me, therefore, the question was, what was I going to do with my life besides write fiction? And I was teaching English at Stanford at the time. I was not, for whatever reason, terribly happy with that. And so the options were, do you want to go into the ad business? Do you want to go to Hollywood and try to get a studio job? I found most of my friends were lawyers. I was interested in what they were doing. I was interested in the issues with which they seemed to deal every day. And so I made what was to most of my colleagues in the English department a breathtaking and probably incomprehensible decision to go to law school.
There were incredible bidding wars over your novel. You got a $200,000 advance from the publisher. There was a $1 million purchase of the film rights. of your novel. I know you didn't expect that. What kind of feeling has it left you with? Has it made you more secure or more insecure?
I think that, you know, one can be very philosophical about money. You know, I have three kids, and I believe that our lifestyle is not a lot different today than it was last October when all of this began. But obviously, it gives you the option to look at your life in slightly different terms. Nothing seems quite as imperative. You know, certainly I don't stay up nights anymore worrying about what happens if I lose my job. But you know, I think that in some ways, money is very important at a certain level in this society, and that, you know, when you're an attorney, the fact of the matter is you're making a living, and you're lucky enough to be living comfortably. And one of the things that's interesting to me about sudden wealth is that I realize how comfortable our lifestyle was already as compared to people who are really poor.
Why do you think there's such an interest in courtroom dramas, from Perry Mason to The People's Court to Jagged Edge? I'm not putting your book in the category of that, but there is this long-term fascination with courtroom drama.
Well, it's one of the few places in a society where things get cleanly decided. Questions of right and wrong, who's right, you don't get those kinds of decisions in life very often. And so it's just like sports. People don't usually win or lose as cleanly. And for that reason, that drama attracts us all.
Without giving away the end of the book, I think that the who's right and who's wrong and the kind of hard line of morality is really blurred when your book ends.
I think that's true, and that obviously is a reflection of my experience. And I frankly consider that moral complexity to be one of the things in the book that I personally am proudest of.
Are you going to stay in law now that you don't have to do it to make a living?
I think so, Terry. I'm pretty much committed to doing that. I am extremely fond of the people with whom I practice, which is, I must admit, one of the great attractions of continuing. But I also like being a lawyer.
How is all the attention that you're getting going to affect your ability to argue a case? Because you might become very well known in the next few months.
I think if I was a rock star or a movie star, it might matter more. It depends. Obviously, the judiciary is made up of people who read and who are cognizant of the success of presumed innocent. I had a funny experience last week. I was in court, and I finished a status call. I was arguing a little motion, and as I stepped away from the podium, the judge congratulated me on the success of the book and asked me why I was still practicing. And obviously, I'm going to be a little bit more of a curiosity, but I really am not worried about facing a panel of jurors who are well acquainted with who I am, because I think that for better or for worse, that probably overstates the importance of literature in the United States at the moment.
But would you have to disqualify any jurors who had read your novel?
Well, that would be up to the judge. I think that is an interesting prospect. I had that happen once. While I was an assistant U.S. attorney, I had a juror who acknowledged having read 1L, my first book, and the juror was seated, and the juror stayed on the case, and the only thing afterwards was that when after the case was over and we had won, the juror did want me to sign his copy of my book, but that was it.
Scott Turow, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you very much for letting me do that.
Scott Turow is the author of Presumed Innocent. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's up for today's program?
I have a report on Secretary of State Shultz's appearance before the Iran-Contra Committee. It's turned out to be even more eventful than we had expected. And also, news of the president's naming the Advisory Commission on AIDS. It does include a known homosexual man. Also, a Roman Catholic cardinal is also on the commission.
What else do you have for us?
We have also a report about, remember that very tough no-smoking ordinance from Beverly Hills, California?
Yeah.
It hasn't worked, and they're going to try to repeal it now. Turns out people did keep on smoking in restaurants, despite that ordinance.
Okay, well, thank you, Robert.
Sure.
Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie La Bamba, about rock and roller Ritchie Valens, was written and directed by Luis Valdez, who shared a common background with Valens. Both grew up in California, and both were sons of Chicano farm workers. Our film critic Stephen Schiff says La Bamba suffers from a common cinematic ailment.
The disease known as the biopic, that's movie talk for motion picture biography, is as old as Hollywood itself. In more naive times, the noble and inspiring lives of people like Emile Zola and Louis Pasteur were certified Academy Award fodder. But America in the 80s is less gullible. We no longer believe that historical figures lived lives as heroic as their deeds. And those scenes in which someone like Beethoven sits down at the piano and he's mooning over his gal and he says, "Hey, that's it. I think I'll write the Moonlight Sonata." Well, they don't really cut the old mustard anymore. The real mystery of any great life, of course, is the act of creation or discovery, where it comes from and why. And that's something that's almost impossible to portray on film because it's an internal process, and film is best at capturing the surfaces of things. What's more, if the life we're watching ends tragically, which is usually the reason that directors decide to make a biopic, we spend the whole movie just awaiting the subject's doom. If you'll pardon an irreverent simile, it's like sitting through a long, long joke when you already know the punchline. Even the best biopics, like Prick Up Your Ears or Sweet Dreams, can't escape these bugaboos, let alone a dopey little movie like La Bamba. Its writer-director, Luis Valdez, never had a chance. This is the story of Ritchie Valens, a 50s rock and roller best remembered for the title song and a creamy ballad called Donna, and for being one of the other guys who died in the plane crash that killed Buddy Holly. Whatever real interest his story might have had has been whitewashed away by Valdez, who's intent on championing that rarity, a Hispanic rock star. He's made La Bamba a portrait of the artist as a young saint. This Ritchie Valens never has a nasty thought, never commits an unkind deed. He sings to the neighborhood's cute little children while his wicked older brother is off drinking and womanizing. And he sleeps alone every night with, you guessed it, his beloved guitar. His life is as dull as his virtue. Every cliché in the Rags to Riches book is trotted out here, from the record executive who discovers him playing at the big dance, to this scene in which he buys his poor and long-suffering mom her dream house.
Wow, is this where you're gonna live? Like a castle, Mom.
This is home. Okay, that's the garage.
Rich?
And over there is the guest house. Huh? Come on,
oh,
come on, slowpoke. Look at it. Isn't it nice, huh?
The only hints of something unexpected bubbling underneath the surface occur in the performance of S.A. Morales as Richie's no-good older brother. Richie himself is played by an unspeakably bland new discovery named Lou Diamond Phillips, who's all dimples and no fire. But Morales has the spark that Phillips lacks. You can see the rage and confusion in his face as his brother's career flares while his own languishes. And when he rides into town on his big motorbike, his dark eyes flashing, greeting adoring girls with an insouciant toss of his head, you can't help thinking, that's what this movie's been missing all along. That's rock and roll.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. He reviewed the movie La Bamba. Here's a preview of our next program. On tomorrow's show, I'll speak with journalist and baseball fan John Critch. He conducted a baseball tour of Latin America, stopping at every diamond he could find, including one on the edge of the Amazon jungle. Also, guitarist Marty Gross will be back with more of his rhythm guitar work, and critic at large Laurie Stone will comment on the Dr. Ruth phenomenon. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Lisa Bruton. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Research assistants from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.